My name is Paul Holden-Graeber, and I have the distinct pleasure, I think today is a good day to say pleasure, of sitting between Esther Perel on my right and Laura Kipnis on my left. I feel like a very happy man today. We're here to talk about a very serious subject, lust, but before I explode the subject, I would like to tell you a few things that are of importance. We are going to talk for about 45 minutes. As you gather, that's about as long as a psychoanalytical session. At 45 minutes, I will be told, in a fashion I will show you in a minute, that my time, their time, our time is over. And we will have another 2 minutes to wrap up. If in 2 minutes we haven't wrapped up and we're still, as it were, lustful to talk some more, we will get a third cue. At that point, you will have, unlike in a psychoanalytical session, you, the audience, will have 15 minutes of your own to ask questions. I insist on the notion of questions. For those of you who were here just in the preceding event on diversity, questions, in my view, can be asked in about 52 seconds, give or take a second here or there. And after that, there'll be a book signing. Both Esther's book and Laura's book will be outside for you to purchase at a discount rate, I'm told to tell you. Now, let me demonstrate to you how the first time at 45 minutes a session will end. Then, at 47 minutes, let me demonstrate how I will be reminded that it's about to end. And then at 60 minutes, we might, if we're still going over time and we're still desirous to speak some more, there'll be a very loud beginning of that Fifth Symphony of Beethoven, which I'm sure all of you recognized. This is part of the Atlantic Monthly celebration. We're celebrating 150 years of the Atlantic Monthly. We're also celebrating 150 years of Freud. So for those of you who have tickets to come and hear Žižek and George Prochnik and Wayne Kirstenbaum, I hope you will come and attend. For those of you who have tickets and are not coming, please remit those tickets as we are totally sold out for that event, I'm happy to say. And here there are very few empty seats, which doesn't surprise me. Let's begin immediately in medias res. And it's a question that I will ask both of you. I don't know with whom to begin. So whoever speaks first, go ahead and explore this topic. Let's talk about adultery. I thought this is a good way of beginning. As a way of saving a marriage. Why is divorce so often the answer to adultery is another way of posing the question. Laura, Esther, who wants to take that first?
Oh, I would just like to start by quoting myself. Will all the adulterers in the room please stand up?
Yeah, it's on the so?
And then I usually wait.
Will all those who have ever thought about adultery ever stand up? Yes, raise your hands. I think that certainly in this country, there seems to be a very great tolerance for divorce and for multiple marriages, but a great intolerance for the concept of renegotiating boundary for adultery, any sort. Somehow people would almost prefer dismantling the whole relationship than to question its structure. That's part of why you can be in a series of monogamous relationships, one after the other, with, you know, and be considered faithful. But if you have cheated once, you are an adulterer and an infidel forever. And why the United States would much rather dissolve it all, I think has to do with the sacred cow of monogamy, which is part of the romantic ideal, that there is something about sexual betrayal that seems to be the reigning queen of all infidelities.
So divorce, you're saying, if I understand you well, is less of a taboo in this country than adultery.
Yes. Partly because it feeds right into the idea that there is one relationship that can be for everything, and that If you find out that this relationship isn't going to do that for you, then you opt out and you say, chose the wrong person, I'll go look elsewhere for the person with whom I can really have everything, rather than question the model or the institution itself.
So to go back to my question, adultery as a way of saving a marriage, you believe that is a correct statement?
I think that some affairs are the death knell for a gasping relationship that was already on its way out. And
but
I think
for a better relationship, it's a way
of
making it.
I think for many others, it is the alarm that gets people reinvigorated and re-engaged. Nothing like the threat of loss to get people interested in each other again, sexually also.
You know,
you recognize? Raise your hand. This is going to be our mantra.
I think that we would have to say that there are different types of adultery and that adultery isn't only one kind of thing.
So let's make a taxonomy
okay.
of adultery.
So the first taxonomy, the first two categories are it's the adultery that becomes known versus the adultery that never is discovered. So, you know, adultery can be used for all sorts of purposes, and there's the form of adultery which sustains a marriage and is kept on the quiet, and, you know, or people who have serial affairs and that goes on for years. Or there are these interesting games that people play with each other where the exposure of the affair has some kind of significance in itself. And I mean, there are endless numbers of varieties of adultery, but I just don't think it's one thing. And, you know,
But you're a proponent of adultery.
Well, I got accused of being a proponent of adultery, and I thought that was a kind of dumb reading of my book, of Against Love.
I didn't mean to say that I read it in that dumb fashion.
Yeah, no, and I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to call you dumb.
No, not this early in the conversation.
Not quite yet.
Let's wait another 25 minutes for that to happen.
I've had to say many times that adultery doesn't need me to be its proponent. You know, it's doing quite well on its own. So,
but I mean, I think it gains some momentum with you behind it.
Why, thank you. But as I said, I was trying to explicate some of the aspects of it that aren't so usually explicated, or do the taxonomy, or look at it without the ethical hammer and say, well, what is it that people are actually pursuing when they're doing this, as opposed to just saying, you know, you're bad and you betrayed your vows. So I was trying to complicate the subject.
I think that at the border of every relationship lives the third.
The
third. The third is that... The third is that person which I didn't choose when I chose you, but that continues to hover around. The third is the manifestation...
And change,
it can be multiple people. It can be the cashier this morning that I saw at the supermarket. It can be my ex-boyfriend from 20 years ago. It can be the person that I would never want to approach. But there is a sense that the third is the manifestation of my desire for anything that lies outside the fence. It's the forbidden. And you can have adulterous relationships that are completely in your erotic mind, in your own imagination, that are never coming into fruition, and that do the trick. You know, but what
the
I'm
trick being
the trick being that they can reconfirm why you chose the person you're with. The trick is that they maintain a sense of freedom, that you have actually one place where you can always go, which is in your own imagination, that is the ultimate freedom we have. The trick is that you continue to imagine other possibilities and you choose the possibility that you are in right now, and the trick is that you imagine one day another possibility.
But all of this must
That's
remain...
That's what my patients describe to me.
But so adultery in this view is theoretical, not active.
Well, that depends if active only means when it is... there is an interesting thing about active. It means what? When people have had sex together, but people can sit with each other like this and discuss books and ideas and be in a completely erotic experience and
indeed,
never have
indeed.
To touch
we
each
are.
Other at all.
Believe me, indeed.
Definition of active, you know?
No. I completely agree. So
I didn't mean to implicate you.
Why not? I mean, please. I mean, I feel that. I'm sorry you don't want to implicate. I mean, you know. But in any event, let me ask you this: Is adultery a sign of a bad marriage?
Look, I am a psychologist, and I work exclusively with couples, or essentially with couples, not only. But My field has tried very hard to convince us that an affair is the sign of a troubled marriage. And I think that that actually is not always the case. I think that there are very good marriages, very happy relationships, but they are not necessarily for everything. And the idea that sometimes people go outside to find something they don't experience at home doesn't mean that what is at home is not good. I think that the prime reason, from my experience with many of the patients I work with, is that there is sometimes, in an ongoing relationship, a sense of deadness that sets in, a sense of flatness. And, you know, if we're talking about lust and if we're talking about the erotic, which is to talk about a quality of aliveness, of exuberance, of vibrancy, of vitality, an affair is pretty much high up there in what can make you feel instantly alive, like you hadn't felt in years.
Alive and at the same time can cause great suffering.
Because the thing is that what suddenly makes me feel alive may at the same time be extremely hurtful for you. I think that every relationship lives with a specter of betrayal from the start. But nobody sets out necessarily to go and betray their partner, but that is part of the experience. That's what makes it so impossible sometimes, is that while I am reconnecting with something, with a part of myself, with a part of life that I so had forgotten, I am also feeling guilt, shame, bad about my transgression, terrified about the consequences of what this may mean for us, for our family, or for our couple. I mean, it's just so all intensified. And, you know, the third, the marriage, you know, the spouse lives at the center of the affair, and the lover becomes the shadow of the marriage. So they are constantly grappling with the third also. It's a complete triangular relationship. And part of that is why many affairs actually don't necessarily succeed once they become just a diet. They were organized in this triangular fashion. It was part of their structure. I mean, I can go on for a long time.
I realize, Laura.
Well, I think one of the things that interested me about adultery was that the basic idea is wanting something more. And more. That's not something that I think, in general, you want to quash in people. I mean, yes, it has its scummy, betraying dimension when it comes to marriage and, you know, the cheating on another person thing. But, I mean, the wanting more is a basic utopian kind of impulse. And one of the things that interested me in writing about adultery was that I thought that I wasn't only interested in the individual dyad or triad or whatever, but the larger dimensions of how it is that people express a desire for more. And that in this culture, it's through these subterranean, sneaky, you know, in the subterranean, sneaky fashion. But I think that that, you know, expression is questioned in every other realm where people are encouraged to want less, to want less from life, ask less from, you know, everything planned for modern living. So I like this wanting more, and I think that is what's at the heart of it.
In your book, Against Love, you quote a philosopher, historian I've always very much loved, who I don't know if one reads anymore today outside of the academy, Denis de Rougemont.
I saw it on your card.
You saw it on my card.
Yeah.
I need to hide my cards. Denis de Rougemont, in a book called Love in the Western World, I highly recommend it, writes this. He says, the one obstacle love can't overcome is time. Say a bit about that.
Well, you know, the obvious thing to say is that marriage is a social contract and that what it's supposed to do is produce stability, and that lust is about something else. I mean, it is often short-lived, and it's destabilizing, or can be at its best, you know, destabilizing in various ways. And so, you know, one of the things that ends up happening with lust is this desire, A, to continue it, and B, to stabilize it. So lust can either lead to a marriage, or it can dissolve a marriage, you know, in certain cases, because it becomes a more attractive alternative. But, you know, this is very widely said, but the question is, you know, marriage as a social institution, and particularly in the modern form where it's supposed to absorb all desires, and lust, are they reconcilable? And I'm not sure that they are. I mean, it's kind of a basic existential problem.
That what is not irreconcilable?
The desire for lust and newness and renewal and the stability that marriage as a social institution requires.
But you, no.
I think my Mating in Captivity is all about that.
Right.
It's about how we go about reconciling our need for security and our need for adventure. And I think if you take out the word marriage and you look at it in terms of, here's how I began to think of it. You know, I would meet happy couples, loving couples who care about each other very much and whose sexual life was dull. And time and again, what would emerge is a kind of a description of the paradox between, on the one hand, our need for security, for familiarity, and for predictability. And on the other end, our need for adventure and novelty and risk.
And
danger, and the fact that the erotic thrives on those. But my image always was the little child, because when I think about marriage, I don't think about the institution. I think about what people do in their desire to connect and to create a sense of secure base with each other. The rest of it, the institution, is actually one of the forms that, it's a fairly recent one that we are doing with. And the little kid, he sits on your lap and he experiences this secure base. And then once he's comfortable and he's kind of taken you in, what does he do? He jumps off and he runs out and he goes to explore and to discover, and he's into the novelty, the adventure, the security, the passion, the lust, all of that. And then he turns and he sees to see if you are still there. And when you are still there, what does he do? He goes further. And it is that balance between, that's, you remember that image? He goes further, and then every once in a while he comes back and he nests again and he anchors us. And there is a tension between our need for grounding and anchoring and predictability and our need for novelty and mystery and all of that. And what we've tried to do in marriage today is to bring these two together. I think it is complicated.
But in this way, you're not completely at odds with each other.
I would say that there are all sorts of industries that thrive on trying to solve this problem, from therapy to sex toys. So it's not
you're
as
talking
if...
talking about the industry that Esther belongs
the marriage
to.
The marriage right. counseling industry, yeah. I mean, it is, you know, the therapy industrial complex. And, you know, I mean, it's dedicated to producing optimism about this situation, but... You know, as I say, there are all sorts of businesses.
What about if Esther actually is helping people?
I do. Every once in a while, I do.
So it is an industrial, what is it? What is it?
I think I said the therapy industrial complex. You know, if
Which
I
then switch to the girlfriend industry complex.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are all these industries that are devoted to producing optimism. But it's like the antioxidant formula is supposed to solve the, you know, fine wrinkles around your eyes. I mean, optimism springs eternal. So,
do you use any cream?
And they're very pricey, these creams, yeah. And so is therapy. I mean, if I was getting $2.50 an hour, I could produce optimism too about this.
But because you're paid less. So maybe that's why you don't feel
that's
optimistic.
That's why I'm so dissatisfied. Yeah.
But let's take this a little bit seriously for a moment. I'm actually quite interested by the fact that Esther Perel's business line of work, as it were, could actually help.
No, everybody's interested in that because people are seeking a solution to this. Listen, I wrote a book.
You may, of course.
I wrote a book with the title Against Love, and everywhere I went, people were asking me, but how do we fix this problem? You know, if you write a book with love in the title, people think that you're going to solve their problems and ask for advice. I could have become part of this advice-giving profession if I wouldn't have felt like a bit of a fraud doing it. So, I mean, the desire for advice doesn't mean... I mean, the desire for advice is there, let me say that.
I read somewhere that you responded to a questioner by saying that you didn't need to be a pragmatist. You didn't need to offer pragmatic advice to anyone.
There's a place for people to sort of step back and contemplate things before leaping in with the advice, and I tend to do that in my books. I mean, there's an awful, you know, lot of advice and it just produces the need for more advice.
I think that there we probably, I always thought that I have one license by not being American, is that I have absolutely no need to find a solution. I mean, this is a country that likes to believe there is a solution for every problem, even existential ones. And reconciling the erotic and the domestic is a paradox to manage and not a problem to solve. However, I don't think therapy is about making people optimistic, and I also don't think necessarily that we live in a society where people don't want more and are actually willing to accept less. Actually, we could make just a case for the opposite. This is equally a society where people constantly want more, better, younger, new, fresh, and have a very hard time seeing what they have and be grateful and appreciative about it when there is something.
I was thinking politically. I was actually thinking of the larger political situation, or economically. I think people are settled for quite a lot less politically and economically, even in the last 30 years.
But not because they want to, only because it is usually forced upon them. It is not, when you look at the aspiration.
People become complacent about it, and part of the point that I was making is it's the kind of structure of marriage that in a way produces that complacency, the ask less from your marriage. So I was actually trying to link those two levels, the political and what happens in the individual household, because I think they're not unrelated.
You see, I think this is how I look at this. Every system, every living organism in nature, in corporations, as well as in family life, goes back and forth between change and stability, between this and running out. When couples come to therapy, they come because they have gotten stuck. And every system that gets mired in too much rigidity and not enough change can fossilize. On the other end, when it changes too rapidly and it unravels, it can become chaotic. This is true for nature, and this is true for couples. I don't think about marriages. I look at relationships. That is very much a different thing for me. They sometimes are married, they sometimes are not, they sometimes are heterosexual, they quite often are gay. I look at two people who actually, at the beginning, wanted to experience something with each other.
And maybe did.
And did, quite often. Different things, you know, I was chosen, I got elevated, I got singled out from the lot, my significance got enhanced. I, you know, felt that I matter. By your gaze onto me, I was able to transcend this fundamental aloneness that so much is a part of the lives that we live today. I think of it in that sense. And then what happens when the thing turns around? I feel like I'm some worn out sofa. I've become invisible, I've become like for granted, I have no sense here. I could be here or not be here, you wouldn't even notice the difference. And then, you know, I don't know that I go into optimism. I think what you do is you remind people that they have both needs and you reconnect them with their desire for both of this and the possibility to see is this still something they can have with each other or not. And not doesn't mean they have to part. Not sometimes may mean that you have to make a different choice about what you have available to you.
So people come to you, as it were, sometimes, obviously for various ailments they are experiencing, they come to you to learn to re-lust in some way.
Yes, they come to reconnect with a sense of aliveness, with a certain vitality, with a certain of energy. They come to sometimes step out of feeling trapped, because they're mating in captivity, and it's very hard to want that which is right there. They come to recover a sense of autonomy and a sense of freedom in the middle of connection, but it is about experiencing both at the same time. And quite often what people do is in the name of connection and in the name of security, they will trap each other. You know, you belong to me, I own you, you are mine, and I even own what goes up there in your head, and that's when we're talking about the fantasy life. Where, you know, and you never own the person. They're never yours. You can at any moment lose them in all kinds of ways. And if you actually can tolerate that, in a way it's a paradox, because if you can tolerate your fundamental aloneness, you can better connect. And if you can do that, you will even continue to desire. Because in a way what I was looking at is, why is it so that loving relationships find it so difficult to continue to experience desire? Not just lust. Lust and passion is an intensity of it that you get every once in a while. And you were talking about the issue of time with Rougemont. I think it's never time that makes it harder. It's fear.
It's fear.
Fear. It is much more risky. You know, Stephen Mitchell, this wonderful analyst who actually was the spine for the model of looking at security and adventure, he has this beautiful line. It's not that romance fades over time. It's that it becomes riskier. It's much more difficult to let go, to show those other sides of you to the person to whom you depend upon for so much. It's much easier to do it when the emotional stakes are lower, contrary to what we have been told. You know, that is one of the things in my field that I've challenged a great deal. Intimacy begets sexuality. And I, because it may look like I'm a representative of my of the couples therapy field, but I'm actually a bomb in my field at this point. I am throwing over just a bunch of sacred cows and assumptions that have remained unexamined. Quite often, greater intimacy doesn't necessarily lead to better sex, to the contrary. Because the way you love has an element of selflessness to it. You care, you feel responsible, you worry, you have protective elements. And those forces that breed love are often erotically deflating because the erotic goes much more selfish, much more raw, much more objectifying sometimes, much less into that caring, protective element. And that's why it sometimes is harder to lust in the same place where you look for stability and connection.
Laura, your turn.
Did you get that?
There's not much to disagree with in what you said. And I think that was a very poignant description of a state in which desire has, you know, been evacuated. And I do think that there is something that is kind of fundamental or inherent in love that's anxiety-producing. And the ways that people cope with that anxiety is often to try to control the other person and produce these, I call them like domestic gulags, these endless systems of rules and regulations, almost resembling the ones about the timing of our session here. These endless kinds of rigidity.
And put on the music now.
I do agree that the kind of playfulness that you would like to, you know, that's kind of inherent to lust and desire, and the desire to control another person, because the loss of love, the feeling which I think you described so well, that somebody is, you know, doesn't desire you or desires someone else instead, is incredibly ego damaging and anxiety producing. The thought of it is anxiety producing. So the answer is to invent all these rules and try to control the other person, which deflates the desire anyway. So there is a kind of cycle to that. And I do agree that the ability to live with the anxiety of the uncertainty of another person's autonomy is a great challenge. So in that, we agree.
There we're talking nearly as if we were analyzing Marcel Proust. I mean, we're talking about jealousy, and jealousy as a motor to keep a relationship alive, is that right?
I think it's Alain de Botton in What Can We Learn About Proust. He has this great line where he says, you know, what...
He got it from somewhere, I'm sure.
Actually, I will, if you don't mind...
I mean, he got it probably from Proust.
Yes, yeah. That's quite likely, but since I got it from him...
Do you think
him,
he's not an original thinker?
Oh, I wouldn't
Which
say
one, Proust or de Botton?
Botton, de Botton.
I would choose one over
here,
that.
Here, actually. He asks Proust, are there any secrets to a long-standing relationship? Infidelity, not the act itself, but the threat of it. For Proust, an injection of jealousy is the only thing capable of rescuing a relationship ruined by habit.
There you have your homework. So,
so your question is about jealousy?
Mm-hmm. Jealousy, and then for you to explore a little bit more this very interesting notion, I think, of intimacy getting in the way of passion.
See, I think that to do that, it's very important to think together about the word intimacy, because intimacy has become the sovereign antidote of our lives of increasing isolation, and it's come to mean something that it never meant before. You know, today we no longer plow the land, today we talk. And intimacy is about me talking to you, and you are my empathic listener. And I'm going to reveal myself to you, and you are going to reflect back to me. And in that experience, I'm going to know that I exist, and I matter, and I'm validated. You know, when you think about Fiddle on the Roof, you know, do you love me? And she says, you know, I washed your kids.
Do you love me? Yeah, no, I remember. I've washed your socks for 25 years.
I milked your cows, I fed your kids, I slept with you, and if that ain't love, then what is?
If I had known, I would have had it cute, you know? Yeah, I know.
We would today call this domesticity, at best oppression, probably. You know, I mean, this is not about intimacy. And this kind of discursive verb, you know, talk intimacy, is very recent. I think it's a very female or feminine definition of intimacy that came to be at a time when women entered my profession, and it certainly leaves out the body and many other languages that we have for expression and for connection. And it really fits a puritanical society to just say, you know, we get close because we talk. But so here
it's words that get in the way?
It's words that get in the way in the sense that I think that privacy enhances intimacy. I think we live with a model of togetherness today that is about candor, transparency, sharing everything, telling everything. Here's the thing. We want today what we always wanted from our partner in committed relationships, marriage. I want security, companionship, children, respectability. And on top of it, now I need my Joe to also be my best friend, my confidant, and my passionate lover. All of that in one, and we live twice as long. Go figure, you know.
I mean, it's twice as long, which
you
is
know.
Difficult.
And then we that really gave it le coup final.
Length matters.
I think that, you know, it contrary to what we often think, it's not always the lack of closeness that stifles desire, but actually too much closeness. But the problem is that the way we live in these nuclear one-on-one relationships, quite isolated from the rest, makes it very hard to not be pushed. And that is a political force that is coming from outside, that is not just an internal need, where with no social support, with no institutional support, it is you and me, baby, and maybe if we have kids, it's you and me, baby, and the Schmurfs. And it's all on our shoulders. Les Schtroumpfs.
Schtroumpfs.
Tu te rappelles des Schtroumpfs? The kids, you know? And that, you know, when you expect so much from one person, in that sense, it becomes much harder to experience playfulness, curiosity, novelty, imagination, those key ingredients of the erotic. You can have sex, you can have your average number every week, but that's not lust and that's not erotic.
You know, I think we've come at a moment here where I'd like to...
Is this 10 minutes before the end of the session?
I have no idea.
My patients like to know that.
I think this is a good moment, Laura, for you maybe to ask Esther a question and for Esther to ask you a question. And we can do it in any order.
I'm not sure I have a question at the ready. I feel very apologetic about this. But, I mean, there's been a lot of advice on offer. So, I mean, we've ended up having a therapeutic kind of conversation. And
as
I said...
Has it been helpful to you?
I feel cured, actually, yes, yes. I mean, that's part of my point, is that all these conversations about love seem to kind of end up at this one level, which is the advice level. And I don't feel capable of participating in that because I was actually trying to ask questions at a different level.
Well, ask
you know,
them
at a
now.
More at a more social level. Well, I guess I would say my approach would be more like this. It seems to me that societies produce the kind of character types that are functional for them. And one of the things I was trying to do was look at these complaints that people have about their marriages and the therapy that's offered to solve it but never actually solves it, and see in what way is this socially functional. You know, so it's not just how do we fix this at the individual level, but how is this working to prop up other social institutions and other forms of power and you know, the ways, the status quo and the ways things operate. So,
but you see, I think Esther was taking a point of view which wasn't just the individual, by talking about perhaps a slight... hesitation to think that the nuclear family was a good solution for our problems. Well, now, things have changed, and we now rely much more on the nuclear family than we did maybe two generations ago. In a way, it brings us back to a great article, actually, The Atlantic published some 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, Robert Putnam's essay, which then became a book, Bowling Alone, mm-hmm. which I think brings us back to, I mean, a fabulous title, Bowling Alone, much better as an article in the pages of The Atlantic than as a book.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking, you know, the point, the point has been made that therapy is like the Protestantism of our times. You know, the way that Weber described the role of Protestantism in the growth of capitalism, that therapy is the ideology that supports our culture and, you know, becomes a way of perpetuating it. So I'm sort of, you know, interested in how it does that. And I guess, you know, that's the question. In what way does therapy, individual therapy, or that approach to solving this, what we both agree is to some degree an existential kind of issue about lust versus stability or desire versus, you know, the monogamous couple. You know, do you see larger social dimensions to that?
I see plenty. I mean, the first one, I think it's an excellent question, by the way, and there is the therapy per se vis-a-vis the problematic, if you want, or the paradox that we suggested today, and then there is what I think about the endeavor of therapy and its social meaning today. I think that we ask from one person today what once an entire village used to provide. That in itself is utterly problematic. Mm-hmm. I think that this is, and when I work in the, you know, in the United States, I work with families, for example, or I work with couples who have children and who are trying to reconnect erotically, sexually with each other. I am very well aware that this is the only country, Western country, with no maternity leave. And if you get one, it's called a disability leave. The child care, no, it's as if you broke a leg, huh? It's mm-hmm. the same. It is also the place that where child care, affordable child care, is out of range for even the middle class women. You can basically stop working just to pay. I mean, I can never forget all of that when I say to people, you need to go out on a date. If I even even mm-hmm. said that, you know.
Because look where you'll end up.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, yeah, it's yeah. So I, you know, family therapy or couples therapy, where I come from a systemic perspective, never was individualistic, never was deterministic, is mm-hmm. always contextual in its thinking, and was and came to be because it looked at problems in context and in relation to the larger social, mm-hmm. political, and economic issues.
Where here it becomes accommodationist because it does provide solutions only at the individual level, and so everything is taken to be an individual problem, and you know, social, any kind of social momentum gets kind of dissolved or
right.
diffused.
So here is the way where that can happen. Because these lack of social supports and institutional supports, in the mind of Americans who consider themselves autonomous and free thinkers, they tend to privatize the problems. It is right. not seen as there is a lack of external something that is impinging on us. It is privatized. My work is to let that be known, that there is, you know, I it's very different when, I think very often people from the world of literature and cultural studies and look at psychotherapy and they think about psychoanalysis. And in the last 50 years, an entire body of psychotherapy and thinking emerged that is not cognitive behavioral and that is not psychoanalytic, that is very political and very systemic in its thinking. So one challenge for me is to tell people that this privatizing of the problems is convenient for a lot of other people who therefore no need to worry about you.
Right.
You know, but I say this in my office. What I also actually at sometimes did in my office, because one of the ideas in your book that I thought was so right on is how, you know, we often tend to think how intimacy can be confused with merging, but what you were highlighting is how intimacy can be confused with surveillance. And you have those three pages of all the things yeah. I no longer can do because I have read this to so many couples. Just sit there in my office reading those pages. They crack up. Now, there is no solution, but there is humor.
You want to crack them up?
There's a few of those that are just,
I've had people email me and say they've read this at their prenuptial dinners.
So
I think it's become shtick. I worry that it's become shtick.
But
no, I don't have that passage, but this passage caught my attention. This modern belief that love lasts shapes us into particular fretful psychological beings, perpetually in search of prescriptions, interventions, aids. Passion must not be allowed to die. Frequent professional consultation and attempted cures are thus routine, seized with desperation, regardless of cost or consequence. At least this has an economic upside. Whole new sectors of the economy have been spawned, an array of ancillary industries and markets fostered, and massive social investments and new technologies undertaken, from Viagra to couples porn. Late capitalism's lourder Lourdes for dying marriages, there. Like dedicated doctors keeping corpses breathing with shiny heart-lung machines and artificial organs. Couples, too, are armed with their newfangled technologies can now beat passion's death, and so on. But anyway, I mean, it's, you know, the title may not be uplifting, but it's a good read. I highly recommend it.
Ironic. I'm really not against love. I'm deeply romantic.
Well, okay.
Too romantic.
But to compromise. Is that what the second part of the sentence would be?
Well, you know, I play a certain role as a cultural critic, you know, a self-appointed role. I mean, in my private life, I'm, you know, as beset by all these dilemmas as any of us. But I think, you know, as a cultural critic, I can stand back from them. And, yeah, I think not compromising is a stance you can take as a cultural critic. And, you know, maybe one we'd like to see more people take. So, but as I say, you know, I'm not saying that I have solved all these problems myself, but I can write about them.
But I will challenge you to not think about therapy as reduced to advice giving in its most simplistic form. Neither is the opposite of it just a slight stepping back and reflecting. I think that part of what happens today, because, you know, I didn't always live in the United States and I didn't come from a culture where the therapist was part of your social milieu. You know, and where people at the dinner table talk about my therapist,
right,
okay?
It's a necessity now. To have a relationship, you need a therapist to consult.
No, no, not necessarily. Sometimes you do, but then you ask yourself, how is it that people have come to the therapist when they no longer, you know, this goes hand in hand with the study that Stephanie Kuntz was writing about in the op-ed a couple of weeks ago, that the average American at this point has two people that they talk to about intimate, private things, right, or when they are in crisis. You know, you cannot forget that. So just so you understand, as a therapist, I don't encourage people to only talk to me. I very much work with them on developing a network, again, for people who often haven't even understood the importance of that. So just so you see, there is a constant back and forth between the external and the personal that takes place in the therapeutic room. But I know the study, and I know that there are couples who talk to me and they have nobody else to talk about. And I also know that there is one subject nobody talks about easily, and that's sex. It's the one you lie about the most. And you certainly lie about it more today if you don't have enough of it.
Well, who has enough?
As much as you think you probably, you know, whatever you've decided was the average that, you know. So to look, you know, what people talk about, their longing, their yearnings. You know, when couples, to go back to lust, when couples complain about the listlessness of their erotic lives, they sometimes want more, but they always want better. And what they yearn for is the experience of connection, of renewal, and of playfulness that sex used to afford them. The erotic is much larger. We modern people have made it very sexual, and it is one of the places where we used to experience that sense of awe and that transcendence.
Perfect. I told you, when she says transcendence, that's it.
C'était parfait.
You have a moment. C'est parfait, hein? I mean, we're talented at the New York Public Library. Now, quickly, you have time for a question for Laura, and then I have some advice for both of you.
We can cut to the advice.
No. Well, you've had enough of advice. Ask the question.
Can you imagine work? Because you criticize work in relationships. Can you imagine that work need not be drudge and alienating, but watch work that can be creative and enlivening?
Oh, sure.
In couplehood.
I mean, the model
not
of...
Not when you write books.
Well, no, exactly. I mean, you know, I'm lucky to do a kind of work that isn't alienating. But, I mean, and so, yes, I can imagine a kind of integrated, creative sort of work. As a model for relationships, let's say. But I mean, the part about can you teach lust or can you teach desire or the point at which people usually go for these consultations when
it's lost, is it lost?
Yeah. I mean, the idea, I mean, the flogging of something dead in order to, you know, instill it with some iota of life to, you know, perpetuate it, it's hard for me to imagine, you know, a joyful sort of work of that sort. So, I mean, I do have the question of when, you know, people are at that state, is desire renewable? I mean, that's a question.
You replied to that because I saw you shaking your head.
Because I think that so many times I was wrong when I thought that something was dead. And I began to see that something can look dead, something can look frozen, something can look like it's been mired like that, narrow, rigid, predictable. And yet, if you think about it as interdependent parts, if you find one piece sometimes to remove or to move, the entire thing can begin to, you know, it's like ice blocks. And I have become much less linear about thinking it's gone, it doesn't come back. I think sometimes it just lives like this. And I think at other times it is extraordinary what people can at times resuscitate inside themselves and with each other, but there was a crust that just sat there for so long. So I am no longer willing to just trust even my own impression when I think, oh, these finished, they're done. I don't always know. It's much more subtle and much more
maybe
mysterious.
It's less optimism than hope that you're lacking.
It also goes back to the time issue, your quote from de Rougemont, that, you know, it's our social necessity to make desire last the course of a lifetime if we want to have these lifetime marriages now. Yeah, but I mean, Lawrence Stone makes the point that early death used to take care of what divorce takes care of now. You know, that...
Transcendence or death.
So now
but we're trying to force desire to last a lifetime, and I think that goes back to the question of timing. I mean, is that a legitimate, you know, thing to do with it?
But there are many relationships where people are not trying to keep desire alive like that. They are very pleased and happy and content, and to live in a companionate, affectionate coupledom that is deeply loving. And that is actually sometimes our prejudice that we have to guard against as therapists, who often think that people should want more, actually.
People are happy in that state. I have no... It's the people who live in these states of low-level depression for years and years and misery because they're not content with that companionship or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, I'm not going to argue with anyone who finds fulfillment in that.
So what do you have to tell us?
Yes, please.
I think I'll leave that for the very end. Now it's your turn to ask questions. And let me just mention that we have mics on each side. And we would like you to ask a question. And as I say, questions usually don't take much more than 52 seconds. Right here in the front, second row. A mic here. Well, just 1 second. Stand up if you could.
Okay, so I have a question about intimacy, like to Esther or to Laura, actually. When you were saying that there is a whole prejudice somehow about intimacy as being the condition of a good, happy couple or love or whatever, and you said actually the other we should be less intimate and we should not talk. And of course, it's a paradox. So I have a question about this because... just as a feeling, what I would say, you know, as a kind of spontaneous feeling, the feeling I would have is that actually at some point when the other becomes too close, we just take the other for granted and we don't listen anymore. We just doesn't exist as an other. I agree with you that there is this strangeness that is missing, the otherness that is missing, but I don't know if it comes from too much intimacy. It comes also from melting into the background of their life, you know, like a piece of furniture, like you just don't listen anymore. You don't have any space. You listen to other people, but not to that person there. So that's just a question I have about maybe the use of words or listening. I'm not sure, but...
I think, you know, the image I often have is that, you know, love work tries very hard to close the gap between two people, to minimize the uncertainties, to maximize the security, and... to do away with the surprises and the unpredictability. And desire is about opening that space again and then bringing it to life. You absolutely need otherness for desire. That is very clear to me. Fire needs air. sometimes when we talk about intimacy and he's right there next to you and you no longer listen to him, what you really are talking about also is familiarity. And sometimes it goes even further into a kind of merging. You know, we are one, and that in that oneness is a kind of false sense of security. And then it's very easy to think that you know everything about the one who's right next to you, and then you can complain about boredom and lack of mystery. Kind of goes hand in hand.
So that the notion of the adventure, really, of being with someone, which is really what marriage is also about, is an adventure of you choose your mate in part because they share your adjectives, and you learn through language to go deeper. So the notion of speaking can be also a deepening of
yes,
a relationship.
Yes, but you see, there is a kind of speaking. That's the list that I read from Laura. That is, you know, and who did you see, and what did you go, and where did you talk, and what did you eat, and how long did you stay, and all of that. That is not about intimacy. That's about a kind of closeness, familiarity that makes us feel like we always know where the other one is, and it can be very nice. It's not by itself always tension or negative, but I don't have anything against talking, but I think that there is a kind of oversharing of the trivial that makes it much harder to stay in touch with the sublime. So that you only hear your partner actually when say interesting things when you are at a dinner table with other people and you listen to them talk to the third. I'm 25 years with the same person. We talk a lot. It's not like, you know, that's been what I've been accused about, that I'm against talking now, you know. But
it's not apparent. So I think, you know, there's a certain amount of practice. But maybe more of it is necessary. Anyway.
Can I just say something? I mean, it strikes me that relationships have become very complicated things. They're like these modern forms of technology, and the language, you know, gets very complicated. You have to have, and this is partly why so much expertise is required from, you know, outside experts in order to conduct a relationship. I mean, just the language of this gets very technical, and who is capable, what ordinary individual is capable of doing this on their own. So it is a new form of technology. I think I use the analogy, it's like trying to build your own telecommunication satellite and launch it into space. You know, it's something no ordinary person is actually capable of. So it has become, you know, the way we talk about relationships now has become this newfangled kind of technology.
Just wait 1 second.
Maybe we take a few.
Yeah. Oh, you want to take a few?
Yeah, here a few.
Okay, we can take a few.
Follow up on the language then. I was going to ask about the language adultery, the word using, the word adultery, because it always feels like, you know, father-dominated society doesn't want their people to grow up, so they should be banned from adultery or become adults. Or it's not like that, of course, but what is the semiological concept of adultery?
Well, before you answer,
oh. Esther had the great wisdom of taking maybe 3 questions at a time. Okay. You had a question behind there? So adultery is number
one. Yeah, I'm perplexed, as anyone, by what seems to be the irreconcilability between lust and domesticity. And as a writer for many of the women's magazines for many, many years, I've interviewed all kinds of people who seem to have the answer. Oh, yeah. And the one person I interviewed years ago was the psychiatrist, this was for young women, Penelope Rushinoff, who played the therapist in An Unmarried Woman, for people who know that movie. And she said, tell young women to masturbate before they go out on a date. And I thought, of all the advice I've ever heard and given, that seemed like the most sensible to me.
Was that what you were going
and
to tell
I
us?
Think, too, of like Carolyn Heilbrun, the wonderful writer and teacher, who said that, you know, certain men are husbands and certain men are not husbands. But the third thing, and I know this is very disparate, is that listening to people who appear in the audiences of the various television talk shows who ape the talk of therapy in this very obligatory, good, girlish, because it's usually women, way, I find so demoralizing, so depressing, so I don't know. I don't even know what my question is, except that...
Neither do I.
Okay, I'll stop. I'll just stop. Okay.
But it was very interesting. Let's take one more.
In the back, the man.
Just
there?
One more woman and then a man. Not in a the man. Back. Go, you're a woman. Go ahead.
My question is actually around equality. As we've seen sort of more equality in the workplace and in the home and more sharing of what were traditionally gender roles, I'm interested in hearing your comments on how that affects lust.
Muy bien. One more. There's a man there. I see a man. Man. Let's get the mic, and we'll take those four, and then if we have time, depending on the music, we'll take some.
A word that's been thrown around this entire conversation that I'm still not really grasping is, what do you mean by love?
Adultery, we should start.
Well, adulterate, it's a spoiling kind of action.
Same origin as adulthood?
I think. You know, I'm not sure I actually did the precise etymology. I guessed at it. That seems kind of clear. The depressing guests on talk shows, yes, I second that. This desire for easy advice, you know, the masturbate before the date, or some men are husbands and some men are lovers. I mean, everybody, you know, he's just not that into you. You know, the desire for the easy advice, yes, we all have that. And I would say for both these books, Against Love and my new book, The Female Thing, I ended up reading a lot of advice books. And I have to say, you know, I read up with one eye as a cultural critic, and, you know, the other eye, you're looking for tips, you know. So, you know, I think we're all very susceptible to that, and especially to the simple formulas.
Adultery?
I was going to say Esther.
I don't know. It's very interesting because I don't usually think in terms of adultery as much as in terms of infidelity. And then I think about it in terms of emotional infidelity and sexual infidelity. But what
so the difference being?
The women in the workplace issue. That was one of the questions.
What interests me about adultery per se is the fact that it has shifted from an imposition on women within a patriarchal society that was there to assure property and lineage. It had absolutely nothing to do with love, and now it has everything to do with love. And it is an equal opportunity statement. And it's gone from an imposition to a conviction. And that's where I become interested in looking at how the issue of sexual exclusivity and monogamy and the no to adultery becomes part of the romantic ideal. The question of equality.
You speak about that quite a lot.
Yes, I mean,
and
I have
democracy.
A whole chapter that's called Democracy versus Hot Sex.
Choose.
You know. Because I think that the democratic values that we so cherish in the workplace, if you want, and even in many parts of our relationship, don't necessarily work that way, erotically speaking. That the flattening, the neutralizing of power differential is actually contrary to the way I imagine desire operating, or not just operating, but the way that desire is constructed. That lust has an element of aggression in it, that wanting, that conquering, that hostility that's built in there, that has something that is often not allowed anymore in the equalizing egalitarian model. And we want, and nobody wants to go back. I think the challenge is that you want the egalitarian model between 6 and 8 in your kitchen, but you may want something else after 10 o'clock. You see? And I think that... those who were steeped into the egalitarian ideal and how it translated into romantic relationships have sometimes found it difficult to acknowledge that. Because it suddenly wasn't proper, because the erotic desire is politically incorrect. And it doesn't necessarily play by the rules of good citizenship.
Shall we take...
And love. There was the love one, but then we have to come back.
Second row here, a man.
Stephen. Then I can keep that for later.
Well, I just wanted to put in a word for psychoanalysis. speaking as a psychoanalyst, I mean, There was this idea that in our culture we have replaced the confessor with the therapist, who is now the one who returns us to society, denuded of our passionate antisocial tendencies. And Esther said, no, the couples therapist, at least the one that she is, it does not accept the social norms, but sometimes challenges them. It's the psychoanalyst who is going to sit in the room and just listen and play that role of the confessor and the calm, accepting other, giving advice and playing a relational role. I just want to say that that is not the role of the psychoanalyst. Mm-hmm. And Freud was the one who said, the problem of living in a culture is where I love, I cannot desire, and where I desire, I cannot love. And that it is the job of the psychoanalyst actually to destabilize the condition of the individual, and that the destabilization is not caused by the analyst, but permitted by the analyst because of the innate passion within the individual. And so the solution, for example, of masturbating before you go out is the same solution as taking Prozac. Prozac reduces sexual desire. That, they say, is a side effect. I think it's the main effect. And the psychoanalyst is
people applauding here, people who took Prozac. And yeah. Making it,
they know.
They know, I know, exactly.
So I just want to say that psychoanalysis is the original, it's 150 years of Freud, so I want to bring him in. It's the original destabilizer to liberate exactly that sexual passion that is the trouble when you go out on the date. Okay.
Thank you. Behind you, there's a man that's been...
I'm interested in looking at this historically, in relationships historically. I mean, even... my parents' relationship versus my own. Now, with education, women are politically, economically, and intellectually more, generally more, at an equal with men. And so intellectually, in the relationship, they're at an equal with men. We were speaking before about how men found an intellectual equal with other men and then went home to the woman. Now, you know, there's more, you're more likely to have an intellectual equal with the woman.
You do pose a question, though, only.
Yes. Do you find, I was getting to that, do you find a difference that is predictable in relationships where the woman, in relationships between men and women, where the woman has an equal or even higher political or economic place in society now as the man, because I think that this is very newly a different situation.
Okay. Take that question. Go ahead.
I think that where you have a shift in power that takes place where the woman in your example is earning more, is more educated, and all of that, I have yet to see it not be a challenge to renegotiate masculinity and femininity, power and lust in the relationship. But it's done by many, many people in very creative ways. But it never is simple, simply primarily because it is so new and different from all the expectations and the assumptions that we have piled up in our head about what is expected in men and manhood and masculinity, and the same in womanhood and femininity. And I think there's something extremely liberating about finally getting out of some of these boxes. There is, you know, the problem of a lot of marriages, if you want to look at it in marriage, is that there is a conventionality to it that made it look like one size should fit all. And maybe so many of us don't succeed at it because we should be able to come up with our own model for it, not because the thing itself isn't doable.
I actually agree with that. And it's what I've written a lot about in the new book, my new book, The Female Thing, that women's demands for equality, gender equality in the political and social sphere, I think got mapped onto the question of sexuality and relations between men and women, such that a demand for men to be more like women got expressed, particularly in American feminism, this is really the American context, as a sort of political demand. And the question of female desire, I think, is actually much more complicated than that. And I think that we are actually all dealing with the confusion between that now. But so I think I actually agree with you on this.
I mean, the interesting thing is the woman who wants the man to be more emotionally available and more soft and more gentle and more this and more that, and then when he does any of that, she doesn't like to, she actually struggles with his vulnerability, because that's not what she really expected in men. You know, and then when he comes and he asks for something because he's finally learned to ask for what he needs, then she doesn't want another kid who needs something else from her. So it's very, you know, the thing about Laura in the female thing is that she really asks women to be honest with themselves.
But it's also that American feminism gave women a sort of language to create a kind of invulnerability that gets expressed in a kind of rigidity or an inflexibility in male-female relations. I agree with that.
This session has been very helpful to you both. And it is for that very reason that the advice I was going to give you is that you... I think you should...
Meet and go for coffee.
No, much better than that. I think you should get into business together. You should open a center, diagnosis and treatment, you know. You should open a center together, you know, the academy and the practical methods.
Oh, I don't want to represent the academy. Don't saddle me with that.
Okay, diagnosis and treatment, we'll call it. But I think Perel Kipnis, to me...
Associates.
Yeah, and I'll be the treasurer. Thank you very much.
Thank you.